Good morning. So I don't know if you are aware that this morning there is another practice going on at this time, animal liberation. So if any of you would like to go to that, but you've come here out of some allegiance or, you know, sense of solidarity or something, please feel free to, you know, bow to the Buddha. And if you'd like to go to that, I think that's, you know, ooh. Okay. Kofia? You sure? Yeah. Please feel free to take part in that if you wish. I'm not quite sure how why they scheduled at the same time. Maybe so that there would be some continuity of teachings. But anyway, that's always a great practice to do. So, let's begin with a little motivation. Sometimes at the beginning of teachings, there are prayers that we recite. I'm not sure what the usual ones you recite here. So often in teachings with the Dalai Lama, there might be what are called the three continuous practices, first of all. Do you know what those are, Jeffrey? Three continuous practices? I think it's called Jugyun Ge. I assume they're this praise of Shakyamuni, you know, first of all, and then praise, you have taken seven steps at the time of birth and so forth, and then some other kinds of short prayers, a verse from the Vajracchetaka about all of compounded phenomena are like these various illusions. And then the Dunshak, the prayer of confession that was composed by, I think, Aryasura. And then often Sangye Churang Soki Chognam La. So if you know, you probably have recited that many times, and you may recite all of these verses with a certain amount of mental fervor, you know, sort of, especially if in the presence of the Dalai Lama or something like that. Oh, okay. Prayers for beginning teaching. But I find that because we may not have meditated on the meanings of all those verses, that's why I don't generally, if it's left to myself, I don't generally recite prayers at the beginning. If when you have a chance to meditate on those verses, the meaning of those verses, like Sangye Churang Soki Chognam La, Jangshu Badu Dagni Kepsuchi, you know, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. What does that mean, the highest assembly? Sangye Churang Soki Chok. The Maha Sangraha, something. What is that? Bodhisattva Sangha. So we don't take refuge in the Hinayana Sangha? So kind of implicit in there, but so good to understand those prayers and have meditated on that. When I did a retreat, finished 6 months ago or so, and I did a long retreat, and every day there were certain prayers, very, very short, but trying to meditate on each word, trying to think of the meaning of each word and take, you know, the phrases, try to experience is the best of my ability at that time. Like, there was one verse, Konchuk Sumla Dakyapchi, Dikpa Tapche Soso Shak. You know that verse? Droa Gela Jirang Sangye Jangjub Yikizung is a verse that's often recited to have a continuity of bodhicitta, sort of like taking the bodhicitta, renewing your bodhicitta vows every day, very brief way. So I go for refuge to the Konchok Sum, which the Tibetans, you know, that's really in Sanskrit, that's the Triratna, right? Which means what? Do you know what the triratna are? This gentleman? No? Do you know? The three jewels. Tri is three, like tricycle. Ratna means jewels. But the Tibetans translated that into their language as konchok. Kon means rare, chok means supreme. So the three rare supremacies, or however you might want to say it, the three rare supreme ones. To me, that gives a little more flavor somehow. And so, especially reading the life stories of the Buddha from his previous lives as a bodhisattva, when he revered the teachings of the previous Buddhas and the Sangha that existed in those lives, he might have been in the presence of previous Buddhas or at times when a Sangha existed. He took refuge, even recognizing how rare that was to encounter the three jewels. So on the basis of that kind of understanding, saying, I take refuge in the three rare supremities. Even the Arya Sangha, their minds, Arya beings, right now can help us if we take refuge in them. So the reason I'm saying that is I'm urging you to go over the prayers that you usually say and study them and try to experience them so that when you say those words can evoke the same experience that you have when you think about them very slowly in detail and meditate on them. You can draw back a remembering consciousness of those understandings. So right now, in lieu of that, in place of that, we're going to just do some actual meditation as we've been doing, and try to develop a positive, similar kind of positive motivation for listening to the teachings. So first of all, relax your body. Relatively simple compared to the mind. Relax your mind. Remind yourself that what I think of when I say relax the mind, first of all, is remind yourself you don't have to think of anything else right now. And first of all, place your attention on the respiration without controlling it. For instance, if I were to ask you right now to listen, maybe you hear the air conditioning or some random sounds, you didn't have to create those sounds to listen. So to watch the breathing, you don't have to control the breathing. Just sit for a minute and just observe it coming in and out naturally. And then begin to add the discriminating factor of being aware of when you're breathing in. Hold that exclusively, and when you're breathing out, and the endpoints. And by holding that as your exclusive object and remembering you don't have to think of anything else, let go of the other thoughts that might be tempting to pop into your mind. as you're watching the breathing, you may notice that you lapse into some complacency, just simply partially noticing that you're breathing in or out, but your mind is occupied in other thoughts. So try to apply a little squeezing attention, watching the breathing. It doesn't mean squeezing your body, you know, getting tight or something. It means tightening up your apprehension of the breathing and leaving less ability for the mind to get involved in the other thoughts. Also, just make an observation of the degree of subtlety of your breathing right now when you're watching the breathing alone. We'll use this as a gauge later, as a standard, when we watch the mind, at the end of watching the mind, to watch whether the breathing is more subtle or the same or more gross. Now follow one inhalation through the nostrils as though it goes to the crown of your head, to your throat, to your heart, middle of your chest, the heart chakra. Leave your attention there and just focus on the mental consciousness. Let go of the breathing. It will continue on. Keep your eyes partially open so there's not a sense of pervading darkness that you might associate with the mind. And estimate, is this your normal state of mind? Is it more agitated, less agitated, more calm? The mind always has some object. For it to be conscious, it has to be conscious of something. See if you can discern the objects of the mind right now. Like watching the fish in a large aquarium. Different thoughts may be coming with their objects. That is, by thoughts, sometimes the word thought may refer to the objects themselves. Sometimes we may think thought is the knowing of those objects. But here there are various objects of thought, like fish in an aquarium. Some may remain for a long time, some may disappear very quickly. But if your mind is already calm, you may get a sense of the spaciousness around the thoughts, between the thoughts, both temporally and within the spaciousness of your mind, although the spaciousness doesn't have any physical dimensions. Try to focus on that clarity, spaciousness of the mind between the thoughts, even if the mind is filled with a multitude of thoughts, even at that moment, recognize they can only be present due to the spaciousness of the mind. So defocus on the objects of thought, the objective thoughts, and refocus on the spaciousness of the mind, the subjective mind or subjective thoughts that are perceiving them. So this space-like quality of the mind, its clarity, its vastness, is not something you perceive with your eye consciousness. Or you don't hear, smell, taste, or touch it. Something that's perceived by the mental consciousness. Here we're developing a generic image, a meaning generality, or a mental image of this spaciousness of the mind. This clear light nature of the mind. The mind has these two aspects of its fundamental nature as being unobstructing and clear, illuminating, and the quality of perceiving or knowing, cognizing the contents of mind. Here we're specifying the clarity as the main object of observation. And we are utilizing the knowing aspect, one part of the mind knowing that clarity. In the so-called Mahamudra tradition of the great Mahasiddhas of India, this clarity of the mind was taken as a starting point to develop concentration, shamatha. And then within that concentrated state of mind, one would investigate the selflessness of persons and eventually the emptiness of this mind, which one has familiar with, this conventional clear light nature of the mind. One would meditate on the emptiness of it, focus on that. So think this incredible resource I have here all the time, wherever I am, if I'm on the MRT or the bus or walking. This is something I can utilize, within which I can develop good qualities if I'm not focusing on it as an object of concentration, from which I can eliminate faulty states of mind. Mainly because I have been born as a human with the ability to meet the Dharma that still exists and so forth, the various factors we call a life of leisure and endowment. It's not going to last long. Some of us may not experience this ability to watch the clarity of the mind for, you know, many years. Some of you may have many decades left, but even that, relatively short a period of time. So to think, to take advantage of this opportunity, a life of leisure and endowment with which I can perceive this clear light nature of the mind and its emptiness, to make rapid progress on the path, all within the context of relying on the Dharma, the Buddha who taught it, and our own Buddha nature that is our ultimate refuge, and the Arya Sangha, the superior beings that have realized emptiness directly, who with their psychic powers can help us if we take refuge in them. I think I'm going to participate in the whatever this is called, class or talk or exposition of the Dharma this morning. Not simply to accumulate knowledge alone for this lifetime, but as a way of healing myself, to use the Dharma like a medicine. To become less problematic for myself and others, to become actually beneficial. To turn my mind to the plight of all sentient beings who've been so intimately related with us in numberless lives, depthlessly kind. These mother sentient beings who are exactly equal to us in this basic desire for comfort, happiness, and the desire to be free of suffering and what is uncomfortable. To start to identify with their welfare as more important than this one person's welfare. With a thought to develop that state of mind of bodhicitta, I think I'm going to participate in the class this morning to heal myself, to develop the merit to achieve the minds of renunciation, bodhicitta, which applies a renunciation in a sense to feeling uncomfortable with the suffering of all sentient beings. And with some beginning instincts and insight into emptiness, that all of these appearances are the result of our past karma. They capture no particular inherent meaning or significance. They're all empty of existing the way that they appear. Make a strong motivation to the reason that we're entering into this next period of listening to the talk is to continue on this path to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And then relax, bring your attention back to the present. How was your meditation? Was it good? Does Alan Wallace mention anything about what he teaches about? He teaches sometimes breathing meditation. Does he mention anything about the to avoid controlling the breathing? Isn't it? I need a translator. What is it? Yes. Yeah. So a little bit like what I was saying. Yeah. So not to control the breathing. Do you find that difficult? Just watching the breathing? No? You don't find that difficult? Good. Okay. You're trained. Okay. So I mentioned at the beginning, and some of you have come in since then, today is a day when the animal liberation is being performed upstairs. Starting a couple of minutes ago, so if anyone was torn between the two, if you'd like to go to that, feel no guilt, just bow to the Buddha and get up, you can go and participate in liberating sentient beings. Okay. So today we're going to be talking about the subject matter is the Mahayana paths and grounds, or grounds and paths. There's a text that's often studied in the monastic tradition in studying the philosophical texts in preparation for studying the Prajnaparamita, and for in preparation for studying the Majjhimaka philosophy and so forth. One of these sequence of preliminary texts is called Salam. Sa is a Tibetan word that means ground. Do you know the Indian word, the Sanskrit word for that? Bhumi. We might even have in our Singaporean lexicon the word bhumi. Does that mean anything in here? Maybe from Indonesian, earth. Yeah, but it often means earth. So it can mean just ordinary earth itself, and it can mean kind of the ground within which spiritual realizations grow, in a spiritual sense. So when we talk about the grounds, we talk about the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, so the 10 bodhisattva grounds. There, probably ground is a little better translation than earths. You say the 10 bodhisattva earths. Almost sounds like different planets or something like that. But the 10 grounds, sort of locations where that have slightly different qualities within which realizations can grow. And the word lam, you're probably familiar with, means path. And you may even have in the street names here. Do you have some streets that are called marga in Singapore? You have, what is this, lorong and different names of different size things. There's nothing called marga. Have you been to Delhi at all? Any of you been to India? How many people have been to India? Oh, not that many. Huh. In Delhi, there's many things that are something marg. So in modern Hindi, a little bit like, not quite like Pali, but modern Hindi, they often drop the final A. Instead of saying marga, they say marg. Instead of saying King Ashoka, they say King Ashok. Have you noticed that? So that's a very common name, even today in India, for a certain size road, marg. So paths, and of course we talk about the lam rim, the stages of the path, right? There, the path, the meaning of path is a sense of that which gets you to a particular spiritual destination. It doesn't mean a physical location that you have to get to, you know, some secret place, you know, like Shambhala or something on earth where you start your journey it's talking about a mental pathway. So it's making that analogy. Also, the grounds are not physical places; they're mental places. So this kind of text is taught as one of the original kind of texts that are studied by the young monastics, males and females, and acts as a basis for further studies. So we're going to be talking about the name of this text. The name of this set of lectures is the Mahayana Paths and Grounds, or Grounds and Paths. But we will be talking a little bit about the Hinayana Paths and Grounds too, because they're intimately related to that. So continuing on to what I had mentioned in the course yesterday on the, what was it called? The four close placements of mindfulness, or the four applications. Yeah. So I mentioned a little bit about the paths and grounds. I may bore some of you who were there, just to repeat a little of this. So in general, to become a Buddhist, I mentioned yesterday also, to become a Buddhist, what's the demarcation of becoming a Buddhist? When you believe in the four seals that certify a Buddhist teaching? Refuge. Someone's saying that's the actual demarcation, right? So just refuge. Who said that? You said that, right? Yeah. So refuge means you recite, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha many, many times. That's sufficient to become Buddhist? No, there's some extra words. To take refuge from the depth of your heart. So that, and that's what I was saying before, to really have a feeling for what refuge means, to go back over the teachings you've received on refuge, what is, of the three, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, what is the actual refuge? The Dharma, right? Or the Dharma. How come Buddha is not the refuge? Pardon? He's the doctor. Okay, well, that's one way of explaining. Yeah, the Dharma is like a medicine. The Buddha was the doctor that prescribed the medicine, and the Sangha are like the nurses that help you take the medicine. That's one kind of analogy that's used. Yeah, that's right. But what? Actually, we talk about different kinds of refuge. We talk about causal refuge and resultant refuge, right? So in resultant refuge, what is the actual refuge? What's the ultimate refuge? Yeah. So what's the difference between causal refuge and resultant refuge? Causal refuge is right now when we depend on external triple gem, the external Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and we try to internalize the external Dharma, we take refuge in it and try to realize it as a refuge, having understood the Buddha had taught it and the Sangha had experienced it and are living examples of the efficacy of that Dharma, right? There's this kind of causal refuge. Resultant refuge means what? Anyone want to... Yeah? The path? So, resultant refuge. Yeah, there could be different results along the way. There can be some beginning results that we have now. But when we take refuge in our ultimate attainment of Buddhahood, that's the ultimate refuge. So, when you become Buddha, you don't need, it's like we were joking yesterday about the path of no more learning. It's like graduation. You can burn the burn the books and everything. So you don't, you know, you've actualized all of that. So in secret mantra, in Vajrayana Tantra, various names, that's one of the very special features. We try to bring the result into the present. So we're taking resultant refuge. And of course, the Buddha experience is one in which the Buddha is the Dharma, is the Sangha. So you're taking refuge in all three, ultimately. So as Jeffrey said, even though we don't have, we're not, well, I can't speak for you. I'm not Buddha yet. I don't know, maybe all of you or many of you are Buddhas who are manifesting here. I could be the last sentient being. All of this is being projected, you know, to my mind as a way to cultivate me to finally get out of samsara. All of you could be Buddhas for all I know. Or you could, some of you could be like me. So that is kind of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha from the depth of your heart is the demarcation of being a Buddhist. It doesn't matter whether you were born to a Buddhist family, as in some religions, I think Judaism, if your mother is Jewish, you are Jewish. In Islam, is it if your father is Muslim, that you are Muslim? Something like that, right? It's just the opposite, father, mother. Interesting, huh? Maybe that's why they argue a lot, those two religions. I don't know. In Buddhism, there might be some traditions in India, you know, that you are Buddhist because your family was Buddhist. Or you may believe that you are Gelug, you know, Gelugpa, because your family's Gelugpa. Or you're, oh no, I'm Sakya, I'm Sakya family, you know, or something like that. There may be some kind of allegiances like that, but really, those are irrelevant. And the real demarcation of becoming a Buddhist is taking refuge in the three jewels. So when we talked about the four seals that are indicative of some teaching being a proclamation of the Buddha, teachings of the Buddha, remember, all compounded phenomena are what? Permanent, all contaminated phenomena are suffering, all phenomena are empty and selfless, nirvana is bliss. So sometimes people say that that is kind of some definition of a Buddhist, someone who accepts those. That may not be, so that could be intellectually true, some college professor or someone who's a Buddhologist or something like that. They use that name nowadays. But unless you're taking refuge from the depth of your heart, why would you take refuge? What are the causes of refuge? Do you know what the causes of refuge are? Young lady? What is it? To free from suffering. She's got another point of view. She says fear. That sounds very pessimistic. Is that right? Yeah, a certain preoccupation to motivate. Why do we take refuge in something? Out of some preoccupation, or say more exactly, fear. Let's say if it's raining, you seek refuge under some kind of shelter. If it's cold, you seek refuge within some building where you're protected from the cold air and the wind and so forth. When you're a baby, if you're suffering, you seek refuge in mommy. If you get boo-boo, do you say the same thing? And is that universal when a baby gets a boo-boo? Or is that just American vernacular? You know what a boo-boo is? Some pain, you know, oh, I've got a boo-boo. You scratched your knee or you hurt your finger or something. You seek refuge in mommy. So the first cause of taking refuge to become a Buddhist is an apprehension of the entirety of suffering and the degree to which you can understand and feel trepidation about the inevitability of suffering, that dictates the degree to which your mind encompasses suffering dictates how deep a refuge you're taking. That's why we take refuge every day. It's not that you take refuge once. You know, you might think, oh, I took with the Karmapa in 1983, or I took with the Sakya Lama, or with the Geshe La, and I took refuge, so now I'm a Buddhist. Actually, you have to take refuge again and again, because the causes for refuge can vary, it can be lost, and we should take refuge every day again and again, try to remember the causes. So the first sense of suffering, of course, for Westerners, the sense of just the daily sufferings. You know, sometimes you have mental problems, worries, what is life about, and so forth. So we may have a more psychological reason for taking refuge, seek some kind of refuge from these kind of problems. But fundamentally, it's said that the initial things that we should fear to take refuge in is the suffering of the lower realms. Why is that? Why not just the sufferings of this lifetime? Why isn't that sufficient? Why isn't that mentioned as the initial kind of entry into taking refuge? Do you know? What do you think? Pardon? It's temporary suffering. Also, the suffering of the lower realms is temporary also, isn't it? It will be long in the future. I think generally it's said that, remember when we were talking about Atisha's presentation of the Lamp of the Path to Enlightenment, the special features of talking about the three fundamentals of the path and the individuals of the three scopes. He said that a religious practitioner, the demarcation of a religious practitioner, even before taking refuge, is one whose thoughts are mainly turned toward what? Future lives, right? So taking refuge also, if your main preoccupation is just the happiness of this lifetime, oh, you know, I didn't get a job, my parents are going to be angry, I'm embarrassed, you know, blah, 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 all of the worries of this lifetime, that doesn't necessarily, unless you have some deeper reasons, that doesn't necessarily qualify as even religious practice. So in a sense, the first initial, before you can understand the suffering of being born in the upper realms, you know, the suffering of being human and so forth, the manifest obvious sufferings of being born in the lower realms, being born as an animal, as a hungry ghost, as a hell being. Those are the things that, you know, if you're thinking about future lives, that's a possibility. And so to seek refuge from that, Lama Zopa Rinpoche mentioned once, he asked his guru, Kabje Trijon Rinpoche, almost Rinpoche was portraying himself like an infant asking his mother, you know, please protect me from the lower realms. And Kabje Trijon Rinpoche said, oh, the solution to that is the Lam Rim. You know, that's what will protect you from the lower realms, taking refuge and meditating in the Lam Rim. So, a different demarcation. Demarcation of being a religious practitioner is concern at least about the happiness of future lifetimes. Does that mean that if you have any consideration that to worry about this present lifetime means you are not practicing the Dharma? What do you think? No, but you were offering some answers easily before. What do you think? No, okay, yeah, that's the answer. But why? if you're thinking about the happiness of this lifetime, you're not practicing religion, you're not practicing Dharma? Yeah, that's not that bad. What do you think? So, my teacher Lama Yeshe used to say, Bodhisattvas still may accumulate wealth, may have jobs, or you know, do various things. You might think that's very unspiritual-like, but their purpose in so doing is to be able to have resources to benefit others. And so forth. So you're right. Simply having some considerations of this lifetime, working for some kind of comfort and having the necessities of this lifetime is not contradictory to the religious enterprise or to the Bodhisattva path. But the main orientation is thinking about the future lifetimes, and how at first, not having any control about the future, taking refuge in the Dharma realizations that can help to prevent you from falling into the lower realms. So that's just prelude. Religious practitioner being one that's thinking mainly about future lifetimes, and taking refuge, the demarcation of being a Buddhist. So have you entered in, and I mentioned yesterday, but so you know, some of you know the answer already, have you entered into the Buddhist path when you become a Buddhist? Why not? You shook your head, so you have to answer now. You're responsible for having... Can I draw it out of Yeah. Okay, but say we say it from the depth of our heart. We actually take refuge from the depth of your heart. Have you entered into the Buddhist path? What do you think, Jeffrey? You'd say yes? So which path have you entered into? That not yet necessarily. If you're taking refuge, not necessarily. Of course, you could, but not necessarily. I think generally, I haven't seen it written specifically, but I think you can say one has entered into the Buddhist path in general, some generic thing. Although I haven't seen that written in texts, generally to enter into the path means having entered into the Hinayana path or the Mahayana path, as Jeffrey was saying, generally speaking. So what's the demarcation? So the demarcation of being a spiritual practitioner is one who thinks about at least future consequences of future lifetimes. Demarcation of being a Buddhist or having entered in, I'm going to say particularly, put myself on record as saying Buddhist path, but say Buddhist path generally of being a Buddhist is taking refuge from the depth of your heart in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The demarcation of entering into the hearer or solitary realizer paths, the two paths that are renowned at the time of the Buddha as being the paths of his lesser vehicle, his Hinayana. Does anyone object to that word? Sir, do you object to that word? Hinayana? You seem to be knowledgeable. What is your name? Yu Qing. Oh, thank you for taking off your hat. That's good. Usually in teachings it's said you shouldn't wear some headwear or something like that. So you took off. That's good. Do you object to the word Hinayana? Yu Qing? Okay. I've elicited some philosophical response.
That's just a reply to your previous question. I think the demarcation of entering the Buddhist path is on course in renunciation. And Bodhicitta. So
Oh, enter. So you say that, to use the terminology I was being forced into using by Jeffrey, to say that taking refuge was sort of entering the Buddhist path. You say, no, you're being more a purist. It has to be either renunciation or bodhicitta or both, right?
So if I generate, so anyone who generates bodhicitta would enter the Mahayana path.
Anyone who generates bodhicitta. So anyone in this room who, with effort, for an instant, generates the thought to achieve enlightenment is a bodhisattva. They've entered into the bodhisattva path, according to Yu Qing. Is it? Only aspiration? What do you say? Ah, okay. So she says it has to be wishing bodhicitta, and he says it has to be uncontrived. So all these are terms that we attribute. But let's go back to renunciation, first of all. So the demarcation of entering into the Hinayana path. And so I was asking Yu Qing, a little bit teasing, because he obviously has thought about these things. In general, the Theravada teachers of Malaysia and Thailand around here, they don't like the word Hinayana. They think that that's something contrived by the so-called Mahayana, which they don't believe is actually the teachings of the Buddha, right? At least some of them. And so the word, because what does Hinayana mean? Hina, do you know what Hina means? Lower, inferior, lesser. So Yana means what? Vehicle, that which gets you on the path to a destination. So this terminology, Hinayana and Mahayana, they think, oh, this is demeaning of the Theravada, the lesser, inferior vehicle. Especially because they believe that the Mahayana is not actually the teaching of the Buddha to begin with. But according to some of the Mahayana sutras, the Buddha himself used the word Hinayana. He said, those of you with intelligence should not be satisfied with my Hinayana, my, Buddha's, lesser vehicle. You should strive for the great vehicle, the Mahayana. The sense of that being that the aim of the so-called Hinayana, which is the Shravakayana, the vehicle of the hearers, and the Pratitya Buddha Yana, the vehicle of the solitary realizers, the aims of those vehicles were to achieve nirvana for oneself, to get out of cyclic existence, to get out of samsara for oneself, right? So he advised those that had intelligence not to be satisfied with his Hinayana teaching, so that there are scriptural references to the Buddha actually using that term. But so we're going to use that term. We're going to go from a Bodhisattva Mahayana point of view, that there is something called this demarcation between the Hinayana and Mahayana. So what is the demarcation of entering into the Hinayana path? One has already become a religious practitioner before, you're thinking at least about future lifetimes, you've become a Buddhist. At what point can you say to have entered into the Hinayana path? Well, in analogy to what was said about the Mahayana, when you have renunciation, when you have wishing renunciation, although you were talking about bodhicitta, when you have effortless renunciation. So we can develop renunciation now. We can have the wishing part of it, wishing to get out of cyclic existence. That's not full renunciation, because you have to do something. You have to have the mind that not only aspires to get out of cyclic existence, but engages in the practices to escape from cyclic existence. You can have renunciation with effort right now. You know, during a long retreat, you may develop a mind that wants to escape from cyclic existence and have a lot of energy and think when you get home you're going to toss out all of your things and become a renunciate, and that might fade quite quickly. But the demarcation of entering into the Hinayana path is the generation of effortless, I think in Tibetan we say solme, I don't know the Sanskrit for that, solme, without, solwa means to put effort in some endeavor. So that means that you have meditated on the causes of renunciation, recognizing the shortcomings of cyclic existence and the existence of liberation as a solution to that. And when you have that spontaneous mind that seeing all of cyclic existence as unworthy, in bringing no pleasure, being the real continual suffering, and wanting to escape from that, knowing the existence of having insight into the existence of the possibility of liberation, when you begin to strive for that, that's called and you do so continuously, day and night. It doesn't mean consciously. That state of mind, I think, like bodhicitta, I may be wrong, but I think like bodhicitta becomes a fundamental primary consciousness that has been induced. If something changes in your primary consciousness and you have effortless renunciation, even when you're asleep, like the same thing with bodhicitta, even when you're asleep, you accumulate merit with this, having this special consciousness having been developed to escape from cyclic existence. That's the demarcation of having entered into the Hinayana path. So different demarcations along the line. Where are you right now? Is anyone here entered into the Hinayana or Mahayana path? Jeffrey must have, right? Have you entered into the Mahayana path? That's very humble of you to say. You know, you might not. You don't know. You might be. So if someone has entered into the Mahayana path in a similar way to renunciation, they have developed an effortless bodhicitta, the mind to escape cyclic existence. This is from this is from the viewpoint, especially of the Gelugpa tradition of Lama Tsongkhapa. Some of the other Tibetan traditions also say, oh no, you're a bodhisattva, you've entered into the Mahayana path, will you take the bodhisattva vow? There are many people who say that. Are you, if I were to ask, anyone here a bodhisattva? You are trained in the Gelugpa, so you would not say, but if it were in some other centers, if they had taken the bodhisattva vow, they would say, oh yes, I'm bodhisattva because I've taken the bodhisattva vow. You can understand there's a certain logic to that, but from the general Gelugpa point of view, you have not, by taking the bodhisattva vow, you have not generated spontaneous, effortless bodhicitta. So you are not, you might be, you're an instantaneous bodhisattva. For some, you might say that you have developed bodhicitta with effort, and it is called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta with effort may not be fully qualified bodhicitta, but you, for that reason, some people would call themselves a bodhisattva. But generally, from the Gelugpa point of view, from the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, the great being. To have entered into the Mahayana path, that the entry into the Mahayana path is simultaneous with becoming a bodhisattva, simultaneous with developing effortless, or in other words, spontaneous bodhicitta. Thinking your whole enterprise, the underlying reason for your existence is to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others, based on great compassion for others. So that's the entry into the path of the Hinayana and Mahayana. from that time on until achieving their goals, one follows either the Hinayana path, we could say the path of the hearers, because the Hinayana has two variations, right? The hearers, the Shravakas, and the Pratyeka Buddhas. Why are they called hearers? Does anyone know? Shravakas? Who were the hearers? Can you give me an example of some disciple of the Buddha who was a hearer? Pardon? Sariputra, Mahamoggallana, Ashvijit. You remember Ashvijit? Did you go to any of Geshe Dorje Damdu's teachings? Some people attended Geshe Dorje. Not many? Oh, that's too bad. So he was talking about Ashvajit a little bit. Do you know who Ashvajit was? I think I mentioned in one of the talks. Do you know? This gentleman, I forgot your name, who took off your hat. You don't know who Ashvajit is. Do you know who Ashvajit was? Oh. Or Asaji, in Pali, Asaji. Maybe you know by that name. So remember when Buddha first achieved enlightenment, he waited 7 weeks before teaching. He was like in Bodh Gaya, kind of walking around and thinking and manifesting that there was no one to teach. This was this profound doctrine. And then he was requested by Brahma and Indra and so forth that there were some people whose dharma eye was only partially covered, you know, that could understand. Buddha knew this already, of course. This is all kind of like an indication that we have to request the teachings. You know, the Buddhas are happy to give, but we have to create the karma to remove obscurations from our mind to receiving the teachings. We have to request them. It's like requesting the Buddha to turn the wheel of Dharma in the seven limb puja. It's one of the reasons. So the Buddha went to Sarnath, where he realized the five disciples that he had been engaged in ascetic practice for how many years? How many years is it? 6 years, right? In that general area of Bodh Gaya, eventually the Buddha had, at the very end, had given up his appearance of following this very extreme asceticism where he had lived on one berry a day and, you know, he became emaciated and everything. He began to take some food again and made rapid realizations. And at that point, the five disciples who had been with him all left. He's like, oh, backslider. Is that a word? Do you use that? What's another word for backslider? Someone who's given up the, what do you say? I can't remember. There's some colloquial word you use for something like that in politics, or someone who's given up, you know. Those five disciples who had been with the Buddha, they were all part of the royal court in Kapilavastu, right? Did you know that? When Siddhartha, because he's not yet Shakyamuni, he was not yet the Muni of the Shakya clan, he was not yet the Buddha, or not manifesting, when he was about to be born, the king asked the wise sadhus, the Brahmins, to come and prophesize. And I think, I can't remember how many were, I think there were six or more. And one of them, the youngest of them, I think five of them, when asked what would happen, they raised two fingers and they said either he would become a universal monarch or he would become a Buddha. Enlightened one that would show the path to out of, you know, suffering. And one of them just put up one finger and said, oh, he would become a Buddha. He was sure. That youngest of the ministers was one of the five disciples later, that when Shakyamuni left the palace to go off on the search for enlightenment after having gone out the four gates and everything, there were these five noblemen, One of them was one of the ministers, and I think the other four were all sons of the other ministers. I may have the numbers wrong. Anyway, Ashvajit was one of the these. he was a hearer. He was one of the initial hearers. He was the one to whom, from whom, Shariputra made his connection with the Buddha. Shariputra and Mahamoggallana were completely separate. They hadn't met the Buddha. Buddha had already left home, achieved enlightenment, taught the five disciples. And Ashvajit was one of those five disciples. He had become an arhat by now. Excuse me. And he was walking very calmly on alms, and Shariputra saw him and thought, he must be someone special. So he waited until he had received his alms for the day, his food, and offered him a seat, offered Ashvajit a seat, and asked him, you know, you are a great being. Why are you so calm and so forth? And he said, I'm not no one special. I'm disciple of the enlightened one. And Shariputra asked him, what were the teachings of the enlightened one? And could he give some of these teachings? And Ashvajit said, I am not qualified. Shariputra pressed him. Come on, give me something. I can figure it out. You know, even if you can't explain the details. And Ashvajit said what? What did he say? He didn't say om. That's as it becomes a mantra. Ye dharma hetu prabhava hetu tesham tatagato haiva dat teshan sayo niroda evam maha shramanaya. No svaha at the end. The om and svaha are the make, when you make a mantra out of it, right? So that phrase, have you heard that phrase before? Sometimes with the om at the beginning and the svaha at the end, they're called the mantra of dependent origination. And there's even a sutra that Geshe Dorje taught about, Mahayana Sutra, where the Buddha explains that mantra and the uses of it. And in the beginning of the sutra, it says who's present, and Ashvajit was one of the people who were present. So I proposed to Geshe Dorje question, did that mean that Ashvajit heard this sutra first and was simply reciting that the Buddha had taught him? Or did it go the other way around, that he first blurted this out to Shariputra, and that later the Buddha immortalized that by giving a sermon about that Ashvajit was at. So anyway, Geshe Dorje hadn't heard that story of Ashvajit, so he didn't comment. He didn't have any idea about that. What does that mantra mean, or what does that phrase mean? Ye dharma hetu prabhava hetu. What's the beginning mean? No, that's bad translation. There's of phenomena. There's no sarva in there. Whoever had translated that is mistranslated. There's no all dharmas, because not all dharmas arise from causes, right? Of dharmas that arise from causes, what? The Tathagata mentioned those, was described by the Tathagata, and the cessation of those dharmas. So that he was talking about the Four Noble Truths, right? The arisal, the suffering, and so forth. So Ashvajit's an example of one of the Hinayana arhats, one of the first ones. Is it worthwhile studying some of these stories of the original disciples of the Buddha? It can bring very deep feeling about the teachings. Later when you encounter them, you understand the context of where all of these teachings came, you know, the origin of them and so forth. So the two kinds of Hinayana disciples, the Shravakas, and that was my initial question, why are they called Shravakas? Or the usual translation is hearers or auditors. How else translated? Shravakas. You know, in Tibetan we say Nyento. both words kind of mean to hear. One means to listen, one means to hear. Niento. So they take, in Tibetan, they take the etymology from some of the meanings of the hearers. The hearers are those who heard the teachings of the Buddha, put them into practice, and then having achieved realizations, they explain it to others. They cause others to hear about their realizations. So there's two hearings. They heard, they listened to the teachings of the Buddha, they actualized them, and then they caused others to hear about their realizations. They themselves expounded on them. So they're called shravakas for that reason. Those were the main famous disciples at the time of the Buddha. The other kind of Hinayana disciple is called the Pratyeka Buddha. It's sometimes translated, Jeffrey Hopkins translates as solitary realizer. Pratyeka Buddhas doesn't mean they're fully enlightened Buddhas. The word Buddha just means, can have the significance of someone who is realized. So the Pratyeka Buddhas, those kinds of Hinayana practitioners who eventually achieved their own arhatship, were any of them present during the Buddha's discourses? Can you mention some famous Pratyeka Buddhas? You know? Come on. Come again? So that's the etymology of the name, solitary realizer, but that doesn't mean that all of them, that was an exact definition. For instance, the word bhikshu, you know what bhikshus are, monks, fully ordained monks. One etymology is, as the Tibetans take it, ge long. Literally it means virtuous beggar. Do all gelongs, do all bhikshus necessarily beg or go for alms? Not necessarily. It's sort of generic. Maybe they're not even virtuous in the big gelong. So sometimes names are given, but they don't fit all of the members. So all of the Pratyeka Buddhas didn't necessarily, there were different kinds of Pratyeka Buddhas, but the main characteristic of the Pratyeka Buddhas were that they had aspiration to be, they were kind of loners. What is it called today? I want to say geeks, but that's not exactly right. Introverts, but not in the sense of being, you know, incapable. They were individuals who were maybe in that spectrum, who did not want to depend on the community or on the existence of a teacher. They themselves, having heard the teachings, and they depended on Buddha somewhere along the line, but they had strong aspirations that they would be self-reliant and they would achieve their enlightenment. In the word enlightenment, maybe we could say with a small e, not the enlightenment of a Buddha, but the enlightenment of the what they considered to be the ultimate nirvana, they would achieve that by themselves in the future. And so oftentimes they would be born because of karma in their future lives, in their progression working toward their goal in dark ages where the Buddhas had not appeared in the world. No universal teacher. They would kind of, their general karmic tendency would be that they wouldn't be born at times like that. But just before the Buddha took rebirth as Siddhartha from Tushita Heaven, he was reigning there as the next, you know, as the the Pure Land, the Tushita Pure Land, outside of the Tushita Heaven. In the desire realm, he took the aspect of looking where he was going to be born. He knew where he was going to be born. Everything was planned out and would take place, of course. And he sent some of the bodhisattvas that were part of his retinue to Earth to check out. And they went when they passed by Sarnath Deer Park. They had seen some Pratyeka Buddhas there, and they announced that the Buddha would soon take rebirth a Buddha would soon take rebirth in the world. And these Pratigya Buddhas said, wow, you know, enough of this. You know, they had, because of being Pratigya Buddhas, they didn't be around. And they rose in the air with their psychic powers and ignited their bodies, their corporal bodies, in the with a fire element and burned up, went into samadhi, and, you know, to wait to take rebirth again. Maybe some of them attained their final nirvana then, I don't remember. But their ashes fell in Deer Park, and that's the origin of one of the other names for Deer Park. I think it's called Rishipatana, the place where the ashes of the rishis fell to earth. Have you ever heard that name for Deer Park? Rishipatana? Well, you can see in the scriptures. Is another name for that particular location where these Pratigya Buddhas were. So the Pratigya Buddhas were different than the Shravakas. They had sharper intellect. So they weren't, you know, they weren't like introverts that were inferior to the Shravakas. In fact, generally, their mode of meditating was one that was more comprehensive on recognizing the causal conditions for cyclic existence. Do you know what they meditated on? Huh? Was it? Ah, 12 links. Okay. Whew. Took me some time to catch that. 12 links, right. So generally, what did the Shravakas, the main teaching that the Shravakas received, the very initial teaching was on the Four Noble Truths. So generally, the Shravakas, they use the Four Noble Truths, as we talked about it, and we will be talking about, as their main way of engaging in understanding the arisal of samsara and how to escape from it. The Pratigya Buddhas also meditated on the Four Truths, but they meditated also utilizing the Buddha's teachings on the 12 links of dependent origination. Do you know what the 12 links are? Everyone knows, right? Is there someone here who doesn't know what the 12 links are? Huh, okay. So the 12 links is an exposition that the Buddha gave in more detail, explaining another way of looking at how we find ourselves within a cyclic existence. Each of the links are not causally related, but one acts as a condition that allows the next to arise. For instance, the existence of ignorance in our consciousness, the first link, avidya, marigpa in Tibetan, allows us to create actions. All of the virtuous and non-virtuous actions, not just non-virtuous actions, but even virtuous actions that keep us within cyclic existence. You might think that virtuous actions, for us right now, virtuous actions are to be practiced, right? Non-virtuous actions are to be avoided, but to get out of cyclic existence, even contaminated virtuous actions have to cease, because they're, although they're virtuous compared to non-virtuous actions, they bring about some temporary relief within cyclic existence. They still are a driving force to be born within samsara. So even those have to be given up eventually. So the example of creating karma from that is in pictorial representation sometimes is what? Do you know? In the tankas of the 12 links, what's the representation of karmic formations? A potter. Do you know what you do? You see in Singapore sometimes in some areas. I don't mean the modern pottery studio. Maybe it could be like that, but they used to have old. You know, you would have a pedal below. You would turn this big wheel, and you would make pots. They would be put in another room to dry, or to be fired. So you're creating things. So like that, out of ignorance, you create karma that leaves an impression on your consciousness, the third link. And later, you know, that those karmic instincts will ripen in some lifetime. So we talk about a nexus of things like this, the 12 links. So the Pratyeka Buddhas meditated on the Four Noble Truths, but they meditated on this more sophisticated and subtle presentation to really develop a strong understanding of our plight within cyclic existence as they're progressing along that path to develop their realizations and so forth. And generally, there were different kinds of Pratyeka Buddhas. There were those that were solid, that were rhinoceros-like. Do you know rhinoceri? Are there any? Okay, rhinoceri. Rhinoceroses. Are there any rhinoceroses in the Singapore Zoo? There. What is the general? Do rhinoceroses or rhinoceri generally congregate in big herds, like the, you know, like in the savannas of Africa? These certain kinds of horned animals, what are they? Wildebeest or something? They have thousands and thousands, herds of thousands and thousands, and deers have certain groups of people. Even lions have smaller groups, right? Rhinoceros. They generally, the lone, maybe your wife, maybe your kid, even then maybe they get rid of them quickly. So some of the solitary realizers, where that name solitary comes about, they would just be alone generally. But the ones that were in Deer Park, there were a group of them before the Buddha was born that rose into the air and burned up and so forth. So they're of another group, another variety of solitary realizer that had small congregations, but generally they didn't depend, and they would all depend upon themselves. They didn't depend on the teachings. So of those two, of the hearers and solitary realizers, you don't generally hear of any solitary realizers attending the Buddha's teachings, because they generally would have left. They would not have been born at that time, although the Buddha makes allusion to them in many of his teachings, and he talks about different people that were Pratyeka Buddhas in the past. Generally, in any story, any Jataka tale, the tales of the Buddha's former lives, that mention Jatakas, generally that's at a time when the Buddha is not appearing in the world, that the Pratyeka Buddhas are around, but recognized by the lay people as great saints and so forth. So both of those individuals follow the Hinayana path. They're individual paths, the Shravaka path and the Pratyeka Buddha path. They have, as I mentioned before, five paths. In fact, the bodhisattvas have the same names of these five paths that bear certain similarities. So it's very useful to know what these five are. So and we mentioned the other day, but just for those of you who were not for that lecture also, they're called the path of accumulation, also called the, well, what else is called? What does Alex call it? I can't remember. No, the first path. Path of accumulation. What else is it called? Second one is called path of preparation. That's what you're thinking. But you can give different names. It's a path. It's likened to this. If a person were to prepare to go to war in ancient time, they would first accumulate armor and horses and soldiers and all of the various things that were necessary to fight the battle. So on the path of accumulation, the Hinayana practitioner is developing the intellectual armor necessary, the intellectual ability to meditate on selflessness, on the Four Noble Truths, on the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, accumulating merit. How did the Shravakas generally accumulate merit? They make offerings. Wait. By samadhi practice? Maybe. But what's the basis of the samadhi practice? What's the way that they really develop the merit to be able to be successful in merit? Do you know? Oh, okay, you were just... By practicing morality, keeping the vows. You remember we talk about the three higher trainings? What's the first one? Practice of higher training of ethics, morality, different ways of saying shila. Very special preparation because, and these shravakas and pratika buddhas, practitioners, who had entered into the path, the way on the path of accumulation that they're accumulating merit, particularly is by keeping their monastic vows. It didn't mean that lay people could not become that, but it was in the time of the Buddha, it was rare. But the lay people would, those that did practice, how would they accumulate merit? Well, they would keep the lay vows, but also they would make, out of symbiotic relationship with the Sangha, they would make offerings to the Sangha, to the, you know, the monasteries and the centers of learning and so forth. By their great generosity, they would also keep the monastic, the lay vows. You know what the lay vows are? Do anyone here have lay vows? Not that many. Oh, okay. So maybe some of you know. There's a difference. Let's say the vows, the lay vows would mean to abstain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, right? Lying, what else? Alcohol, right? Generally, five precepts. Sometimes you would add other things like not dancing, not wearing perfume, and things like that, but that when you take for 24 hours. Generally, say for instance, one particular day, if you didn't kill, could you say that you had accumulated merit that day? No, not necessarily. If you'd taken the vow not to kill, and you'd kept that vow, but there's a difference between simply not having done something, you would just simply not having killed. Like, has anyone killed today? You won't answer if you really, in this setting, you wouldn't say if you did. But simply not having killed doesn't mean that you've accumulated virtuous karma. If you'd made a determination, a vow, a promise not to kill, and you had abided by that promise, depending on the strength of that promise, especially if you promised the Buddha, you'd taken a vow before the Buddha not to kill. Today, not having killed, you would accumulate virtuous karma. Whereas not having taken the vow, simply not killing today, not having thought about it, not even given the opportunity, you wouldn't create any virtuous karma because of that. So the lay people would create virtuous karma by taking the lay vows and making generosity toward the Sangha, the symbiotic relationship with the Sangha. What did the Sangha do for the lay people? They just took food and clothing and the requisites of, you know, housing and so forth. Sangha were just real beggars. No, they had a symbiotic relationship. You know what symbiotic means? Do you know what that word means? What does it mean? Helping each other, right? Like the little birds that live on the rhinoceros eat the bugs out of the rhinoceros's ear. So the birds profit and the rhinoceros profits. They have a symbiotic relationship. Certain plants live in conjunction with one another, have a symbiotic relationship. So the Sangha, what does the Sangha provide to the lay people? Oh, come on. Teaching, inspiration, example. They were like, as you said, the nurses. Or did you say that? You said the Buddha was the doctor and the Dharma was the medicine. I don't know if you mentioned the nurses. So that was a great, you know, an inspiration to the laity. The Sangha provided that back. So the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas would, on the path of accumulation, by accumulating merit and accumulating the teachings and the wisdom, they would be meditating on the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. We'll mention that a little bit in the subsequent lectures now, but if you have a chance to come next Saturday, we'll talk about that also in the context of the four close placements of mindfulness, the 16 aspects. They would meditate on that and develop their concentration, so they would even have single-pointed concentration. If they would understand selflessness, they could even have a single-pointed meditation on that. They would be trying to enhance that to the point where they would be able to, within the calmness of single-pointed concentration, calm abiding on emptiness, they would have the ability to analyze within that without disturbing the calmness, which is called the generation of vipassana, higher insight. And when they had the combination, the union of shamatha and vipassana, correctly understanding emptiness, they would enter into the second of the five paths called the path of preparation. Remember? We talked about yesterday. So on the path of preparation, or some people like to translate it as application, in one sense, it's called path of preparation because it's preparing you to realize emptiness directly, to realize selflessness directly, or you're applying the teachings to that. I like preparation better somehow. That's generally how it's been translated. So that has four levels, and I had left out something yesterday, so I'll try to fill in for. I forgot. What's her name? What's your name? Tenchu? Lianchu. Lianchu had asked what one of these was called, and I forgot yesterday, so I was trying to fill in. So they're called heat. The four levels of the path of preparation. Heat, peak, forbearance or patience, highest mundane dharma. Highest mundane practice, you might say. So the first three levels all have some duration, long period of time. So they're divided into three parts, small, middling, and great. Small, middling, great. Small, middling, great. The last one takes place very, very quickly, maybe even in a very short period of time, one meditative session or something like that. So that's not divided up into three parts. So the first one on the path of preparation, the hearers or solitary realizers start having some intuition now of what it would be like to realize selflessness or emptiness directly. That kind of wisdom, as I mentioned yesterday, is sometimes likened to a fire, to heat, that can burn up the fuel of what? What is it? What does that kind of wisdom burn up? Can burn up negative karma, and likewise, it can, when you have the direct realization of emptiness, it can destroy and cease the delusions. It can burn them up also, the fire of wisdom. So sometimes that's likened to, that wisdom is likened to a fire. Here yet, at the very beginning of the path of preparation, there's not yet a fire, but there's some heat. It doesn't mean physical heat. Again, it's talking about psychic. And when you talk about psychic heat, it's not talking about Tummo. One of the members of the class yesterday had asked at the end, what about Tummo? That's also psychic heat. Or maybe he didn't use that word, but that you might think. But that is actually usually in secret mantra of Vajrayana. When you talk about Tummo, that's more of a physical, subtle physical heat element, fire element. Whereas when we talk about the heat of the path of preparation, it's something mental. I don't think there's any particular kind of physical manifestation of that heat. But there's an intimation of the ability to realize emptiness directly at that point. The second part is called peak. And Lien Chou, so easily forget it. Lien had said, asking me, what was the etymology of that? And I said, I've forgotten. So I checked. That's what you should do too. If I ask you some question or something comes up and you've forgotten or you don't know, you should try to find out. Do you do that? You do? Okay, good. He does, at least. So peak means, and the second level, the ability of karma to throw you into the lower realms has been radically reduced. This is you've reached the peak of the ability of karma to bring about those disastrous results. On the next level, the level of patience or forbearance, in fact, on the second level, on the peak, they've been reduced. The power of the karma is reduced so much that in general, you will not be reborn in the lower realms from that time onward. Although officially, let's say doctrinally, it's only from the third level, the patience or forbearance level, that you have this sense of security that you will no longer be reborn in the lower realms. You would definitely not be reborn in the lower realms due to karma. As a result of your continued understanding of selflessness and emptiness. Then on the fourth level, it's called highest mundane dharma. But you remember dharma? What does dharma mean? Do you know? Is anyone? Are you Indian? Your family's Indian. What does dharma mean? The truth. Okay. What else does it mean? Phenomena. Practice. Different kinds of practices. There's said to be 13 different meanings of dharma, maybe even more, but generally they renown 13 different meanings of dharma. Generally, the Sanskrit word dharma comes from root. Most of the Sanskrit words, kind of like Hebrew, they have some just consonants together, or semi-vowels and consonants together that are root. And you add vowels to make the various words. You know that? About Sanskrit? No? Okay. So the root of dharma, the root is dhrir, which basically, that basic root means to hold up, to uphold. So dharmas are called phenomena in the sense that phenomena uphold their own existence. The holy dharma, what we call the sadharma, like the Buddha's teachings and practices, they're called dharmas because they hold you up from suffering, as opposed to the worldly dharmas. What are the worldly dharmas? Generally, there's said to be 8 worldly dharmas, you know, if you condense them down. Do you know, have you heard of the 8 worldly dharmas? Have you heard? So the 8 worldly concerns that most of us are generally concerned with and that we think uphold us from suffering, but they don't really. For instance, what? Pleasure of the senses, possessions, praise, fame, reputation, fame, yeah. And then the opposites of those you want to avoid. So we think if you have pleasure of the senses, if you have money, possessions, if you're famous, generally that goes along with power also, and if you receive praise, even to the extent of hearing nice ego-pleasing words like "I love you," we feel we need that, and that's what the world lives on, right? Even if you don't have power, even if you don't have a lot of pleasures, you know, big, you know, fantastic pleasures, you don't have money and power, you don't have money, you don't have fame and power, but you still, Lama Yeshe used to say, of those eight dharmas, still, even as a hippie, you've given up everything else, you've given away your possessions and everything else, still you crave for some recognition of your peers or those close to you or your loved ones. You know, it's too sweet to hear sweet ego-pleasing words and sounds. Those are called the eight worldly dharmas. So dharma has many different connotations. So when we talk about the highest of the path of preparation, heat, peak, patience, highest worldly dharma, highest worldly. Here is kind of like highest worldly practice. It's at that point, and again, it's not divided as the first three levels are. It's not divided into three parts. It's a relatively short period of time when you're so close to realizing emptiness directly, because the demarcation of entering into the path of preparation was what? Do you know? We talked yesterday. Do you remember? When you have a union of calm abiding and vipassana, realizing emptiness directly? No, just with a mental image still, generic, with intellectually, say conceptually. But wow, this is much more than we have. Not only do they have a correct understanding of emptiness, a realization. Most of us are now dealing on, if we do believe in it, it's just a correct belief for many of us. If we have some insight into emptiness, we don't have the ability to concentrate on it with tranquil abiding, let alone a union of tranquil abiding and special insight. So that was a demarcation of entering into the path of preparation. The demarcation of entering into the path of seeing comes about from that last moment of the highest worldly dharma, the fourth level of the path of preparation. There, the mental image that is preventing, like the veil that is preventing you from realizing emptiness directly, has thinned to the point where you have the highest mundane practice. So mundane, why is it called mundane as opposed to supramundane? Highest mundane practice. Do you remember? I might have alluded to it. Remember? Sometimes we talk about everything before the path of seeing, before direct realization of emptiness, is called the mundane path or the worldly path. Literally it means worldly, jikten belam, the worldly path. And after that point, from the point of realizing emptiness directly, is called the supramundane path. That's just a way of saying, you could say, beyond the ordinary worldly path, jikten ledepa. Jikten means world or loka, and ledepa means past beyond. So this is the highest worldly dharma, that fourth level of the path of preparation, is the highest of the mundane practices, highest mundane endeavors. The next moment after that, one will enter into the supramundane path, the path that realizes emptiness directly. One becomes an Arya being. Does it make sense? In Italy, there's always they would say "a capito." I think it's "capisci." I can't remember my Italian now. Anyone? No one here knows Italian, unfortunately. They would say, "Do you understand?" And they say, "Yeah, ho capito. I understand." So the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas go through a similar kind of thing. They accumulate both merit and understanding and wisdom on the path of accumulation. And when they have a union of tranquil abiding and higher insight into emptiness, even with a generic image, even though it's conceptual, they enter into the path of preparation. They go through these four stages where they enhance and apply the teachings, especially understanding emptiness as applied to the four noble truths. Because you might think that they're just meditating on the emptiness of one thing. Generally, the Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas all are meditating not just on emptiness in general, they're meditating on the emptiness of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. You could say that the Four Noble Truths in general, some of the 16 aspects are things that are intellectually formed, easily understood, so it's not necessary that they're meditating on each of those 16 aspects. Some of them may have been disintegrated very easily. But they're meditating on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths, that suffering doesn't exist inherently, the causes of suffering don't exist inherently, that even cessations themselves do not exist, nirvana does not exist inherently, and that the path does not exist inherently, sort of like the emptiness of emptiness, the emptiness of the conch of the wisdom that realizes emptiness. So from the path of seeing, and seeing doesn't mean, as you said, doesn't mean seeing with the eyes. It means, the analogy is used because we see things through the eyes with what kind of perception? Do we realize things conceptually through the eyes? You may not know what that means. Conceptual means the opposite of bare perception. Generally, eye, ear, nose, taste, and tongue realize their objects directly without any kind of intellectual intermediary images, not through conception. The eyes realize directly, like the ears and so forth. So when we talk about seeing emptiness, the path of seeing, we're talking about now the mental consciousness has transitioned from the mundane path where it's realized emptiness with a mental image, to the point where it no longer depends on that mental image and realizes it barely, directly, just like the eyesight sees things directly without any intermediary. So it's said to be the path of seeing. And I mentioned there are many famous verses. One that I recite daily says something like, because it transcends the objects of other sight, ultimate truth is to be viewed with the eyes of prajna, wisdom, and jnana, or gnosis. You know, in Tibetan we say sherab and yeshe, you know, regular wisdom, like the prajna paramita, and the deeper kind of wisdom that realizes both levels of truth at the same time that we call gnosis, or not noses, gnosis. My teacher, Geshe Zopa, always joked about that. There was something about when he talked about neutral feelings, he'd always say, I don't mean Chinese noodles, noodle, because his English was not so precise. It sounded like he was saying noodle feelings. He said neutral feelings, not noodle feelings. And when he talked about gnosis, he liked to translate this second kind of wisdom. What do we translate it as usually, Yeshe? primordial wisdom, or there's other exalted wisdom as opposed to regular wisdom. So one is called prajna, like we talk about the prajna paramita. You would think that's the highest wisdom. The highest wisdom is attained associated with the 10th bhumi, where you have a special training in the perfection of this gnosis or jnana in Sanskrit. That is a kind of wisdom that not only realizes emptiness, but it also realizes the conventional nature of phenomena, the fact that phenomena only exist as imputations. They have no inherent existence from their own side, but it's bridging those two truths. So on the path of seeing, one sees, so to speak, emptiness directly for the first time, and in so doing, in that first meditative session, one burns up a certain level of afflictions or delusions. One has a true cessation of them. Remember what true cessations are? They're cessations so that something has been uprooted from the very root so that it will never grow again. It won't function any longer, and it won't grow again in the future. If you just cut off things at ground level with a scythe or a machete or a knife or something like that, lawnmower, you think your whole this ground now is, oh, so all the weeds are gone. But if you wait after the rain, a couple of days of sunlight, then if the roots are still there, it can start to grow again. So generally, that's what we are doing now when we apply antidotes. We cause the certain afflictions to diminish, kind of like to ground level. Maybe even if we have very good concentration and understanding of things, we can cause the delusions to diminish so that they're unapparent. But as the roots of them are still there, when the right causes and conditions arise, over time, they begin to grow again. After you do your Vajrasattva retreat, if you do a 3-month Vajrasattva retreat, you may come out and say, ah, I'm pure. I've purified all my attachment, my anger. I'm never going to fall under the influence. And then someone offers you a piece of durian or pecan pie or something like that. And under the influence of that object, it acts as a cooperative condition for them to grow up again. But on the path of seeing, certain of the afflictions that have been generated artificially, I'll explain what that means in a second, those are ceased, so they will never arise again. Certain things that, certain of the delusions that have come about from wrong thinking this lifetime, based sometimes on non-Buddhist teachings, sometimes on even wrong understanding of Buddhist teachings, sometimes imprints of those wrong understandings from previous lives. All of those are ceased. They're called, various names it could be called, the intellectually formed delusions, artificial delusions or afflictions. What else do you, how you'd like to translate? The ones that are the afflictions that are ceased on the path of seeing. Intellectually acquired. Okay, that's someone's agreeing. Okay, intellectually acquired, intellectual. So interesting. You're using a word here, obstruction. So generally, we say there are two kinds of obstacles or obstructions, mental obstructions to achieving the goals of nirvana or an enlightenment. The ones that the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas eliminate are what are called what? The deluded obstructions. or say nyundib in Tibetan, the obstructions of the afflictions. What that means is they eliminate the grasping to a self of persons, and from the highest philosophical point of view, they also realize the emptiness of all phenomena. Not all the schools say that they realize that. Maybe they just, some schools say they just realize the selflessness of the person. In so doing, if you've done some meditation on this, you realize that that deprives the rest of our delusions, our attachment, our hatred, jealousy, of their motivating force. That's kind of like, that's the root. Said to be the root of all of the delusions, like when you pull out something from the root. If you can get it out from the root, even though you didn't cut it off, chop it up, all of the delusions, they no longer are going to function. So those kinds of obstructions are the main ones, or the only ones, that the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas are eliminating on the path of seeing, and the next path, the path of meditation or familiarity, until they achieve their goal on the fifth path, the path of no more learning. I'll mention more in our afternoon session, but just to give a couple minutes, anyone have any questions? No? You have to go? Oh, okay. You have to go? You can go, go. Yeah, go on, go. Yeah, no, go. I know how it is sometimes, yeah. Yeah. You have to be more proactive, Weichin. Hey, he's over here. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Whenever, since we are in the hearer's path, the five path, then the Theravada also mentions about the four abiding. It's like, you know, the Sotapanna, three maintainer, one returner. And so where are that demarcation of the ten path of the hearers?
So put your hand over the top so it doesn't... That's I was told that when they put up the volume of that... So when they put up the volume of that, then sometimes there's some feedback between the two. So good question, and you've anticipated something we'll talk about this afternoon. So from the path of seeing, one has become an Arya being, right? And there are said to be, general in the Hinayana path, there are said to be four kinds of Aryas. Those that have entered the path, the stream enterers, those that are called once returners, right?
Yeah, so the stream enterer first, then stream, once returner.
Then once returner.
Then never returner. Then
Non-returner, and then arhat. They're all different kinds of... it doesn't mean they're different varieties that can exist at the same time. They're in one person's progression toward nirvana, toward the state of arhatship, because once one has achieved the state of being an Arya being, one doesn't lose that. That's irreversible. One has realized emptiness directly. Generally, although in some of the Hinayana schools it says that you can fall from that, you can even fall from arhatship, the Mahayana higher schools say, no, that's rubbish. I don't know what else you'd say. That you can't fall from these realizations. So there is something called entering into the stream, returning once, not returning at all, and arhatship. And I'll explain about that in detail this afternoon. So in deference to some of you who have to go to the toilet, I'm going to end right quickly now. I know how that is. I have to, come on. Even the lamas, sometimes they've called lecture because they had to go make pee-pee. You know, it's okay. So relax. Just try to dedicate the energy that we created this morning, the virtuous karma. Think in whatever way this ripens in the future, may become the cause of my continued spiritual progress on the Buddhist path, may I develop the three principles of the path: renunciation, spontaneous renunciation, actual effortless bodhicitta, and the wisdom that realizes emptiness, progressing along the bodhisattva path, encounter secret mantra very quickly, and quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings as a result of these merits. And I'll mention later in detail, but you can, if you know what it means, you can meditate on the emptiness of the three spheres to seal the dedication, thinking the karma that was generated does not exist inherently, just mentally imputed. The action of dedication, trying to link up these karmic seeds, virtuous seeds, with the goals, that actually easily understandable, is just a name imputed to that process. And the goals dedicated to enlightenment, realization of renunciation, bodhicitta, realization of emptiness, and so forth, all of those, none of those exist inherently. They're all empty of inherent existence, yet still exists merely as imputations that function. Okay, thank you very much. So see you in an hour and a half. Have a good lunch. Get up. Leave, make a path for her so she can get it. Brother Sweet Kim, how are you? So nice to see you. No gray hair. No gray hair. Oh, a couple, yeah. Four strips. Oh, from Buddha?
From Buddha? This is from India.
From India? From me. Thank you very much. From you, obviously, yeah. Thank you so much. So, if you...